Bobbish.
Thank you for having me. It's especially nice to be in a room full of what I call weirdos, which is people who use technology that's a bit outside the mainstream, and especially people who try to deploy this technology, right? To go a little bit weird, but in touch with quote-unquote reality. And in that regard, I want to talk about a WebAssembly in particular, which sounds like it should be such a great thing for us, but it hasn't really panned out so far. And so I think everybody's heard of WebAssembly. It's 6 years old at this point. You know, time flies, I know. And basically, you get the pitch, and like, oh, it's just this exciting new universal compute platform. That sounds great. I want a universal compute platform, and I want an exciting new one, too. And so what's inside it? Okay, well, let's look. To me, the two interesting things of WebAssembly, what it's composed of, that I think are novel when combined with success, are that it contains a number of operations that map pretty well to low-level CPU operations. So it's a low-level machine language, assembly language, whatever you like to call it. And if you compile your software to WebAssembly, you should get a similar performance to compiling it to native. This is relatively new, right? I mean, we've had some experiments in this regard in the past, but never one that's had so much success as this. The other aspect that I think that is interesting about WebAssembly is that it's built to enable composition. And it's built in such a way that it uses the principle of least authority. By default, a module shares nothing with its host or with other modules. You have to explicitly grant it capabilities from the host when you instantiate it, from other modules, also when you instantiate it by linking. We have no undefined behavior. You should be able to build reliable systems out of instantiations of a number of isolated components, which is great. Right? This all sounds like stuff we want, right? So how do you use it in practice? It's a compilation target, right? You have to compile to WebAssembly. So the pitch is compile your code to WebAssembly. You'll get easier distribution to everywhere that can run WebAssembly, which is everywhere now. And you can easily compose it with other systems, maybe even other parts of the systems that are written in other languages. And at this point, we start to get on the hype train, right? Because this is my slide with all the exclamation marks. We haven't even reached the peak of like the hype curve of WebAssembly right now, but like, there's a lot of money flowing into it right now, and it's making people a little bit crazy. Like, and so one of the pitches is like, it's in all the browsers, you know, you can serve your code to everyone in the world, to all your WebAssembly engines, and all your phones, and all your pockets, and all your tablets, and all your laptops, and all your everything else. And wait, there's more, you know, WebAssembly is on the edge, right? All of the content distribution networks, your Akamai's, your Fastly's, your, you know, what have you, they all run, or can run WebAssembly on computers that are close to your users. So if you're building a web service, maybe you want to, you know, distribute out like some of your computation to these places that are close to where your users are asking things for. It's getting used even in weird places to this composition goal is working out even in the case of, for example, like desktop software development. So if you have a library that you don't trust, which is all of them that are written in C, you can then compile that library to WebAssembly. This is a little bit weird, but compile that library into WebAssembly. Compile that WebAssembly into C, link that C into your C program, and you effectively have isolation between these two parts by construction. The fact that you've gone through WebAssembly lets Firefox load like parsers for the OGG format or XPath or a number of other libraries into Firefox without bringing in risk to Firefox or to Firefox users. And finally, I hate to mention the K word, but you know, like, containers won because they were a lighter weight virtual machine. WebAssembly is going to win in the kind of cloud space because it is a lighter weight container, right? So everyone that's selling you Kubernetes right now is going to sell you Kubernetes with WebAssembly or different kinds of cloud composition schemes. So why aren't we winning, right? This sounds so good. Why aren't we winning? Well, it's because, in practice, WebAssembly is just a weird backend for a C compiler, right? And we don't compile our code through a C compiler. We might compile our language runtime through a C compiler, but like, I'm not compiling Clojure through a C compiler. I'm not compiling Scheme through a C compiler. We're not winning, right? So who's winning? C, C++, Rust. maybe a little bit of Go, maybe a little bit of Zinc, but like really those are the main players. But what about us? What about us? We want to win too, you know? Are we just, you know, not putting in the effort, or is there some fundamental reason why Haskell and Scheme and Erlang and all these things, why we are not winning on WebAssembly at this point? And to me, the answer is yes. Yes, I do think there is a fundamental reason. And it is that WebAssembly, in its initial form, 1.0 form, the minimum viable product form, or in the form as it's currently deployed, which is WebAssembly 2.0, which is WebAssembly 1 plus a few more extensions, is not well suited to languages with garbage collection. Right? This is a fundamental issue. This is what has made it so that our languages aren't really having success in WebAssembly. And if we look into why, there are a few funny details here. So if you have a language that has garbage collection, let's say Scheme, for example, and you want to target WebAssembly 1.0, what do you do? Right? Where are your values going to live? Well, in WebAssembly 1.0, we have one answer. And the answer is what we call linear memory. Linear memory is just memory with a simplified layout. It's just a buffer accessed by index. In this case, WebAssembly, as you might know, has a text format that corresponds very closely to the binary format. So in this case, we're going to ask for 10 pages of memory. Each page of memory in WebAssembly is 64 kilobytes. That gives us 640, enough for anybody, as we all know. And we're going to use it all for our garbage collected memory. We're going to have a heap pointer, and we're just going to bump pointer allocate from beginning to end. Okay, that's how we're going to store our data. This is just like when you compile the data. I'm not going to go into too many details for this function, but the basic thing is when you go to allocate some number of bytes, okay, you're going to bump the heap pointer, but if you bump it past the end of memory, you're out of memory. At that point, you need the garbage collector. So that's what we have down here in bold. We're going to call our garbage collector and retry if we run out of memory. Well, what does this mean? It means we have to ship a garbage collector in the binary, right? When you compile your program, which does something that's not garbage collection, to WebAssembly, your compiler and toolchain has to include a garbage collector in the artifact that you deliver to your users. Already, that's annoying because it's size. But it's annoying for many other reasons. And it's so annoying that it pushes the calculus from okay to oh no, I'm not going to do that, right? And so I'm going to go into the reasons why. So first of all, you ship a garbage collector. Is it going to be a good garbage collector? No. Because there are hundreds of person years in garbage collectors and browsers, and you are not going to do that for your garbage collector in WebAssembly. Right? Your garbage collector is probably going to be stop the world. It's probably not going to be parallel. WebAssembly has some multiprocessing capabilities, but it doesn't notably have the ability to create a thread on its own. It's probably not going to be concurrent. I'm going to ship a bad GC. Okay. But we have a problem, and the problem is roots. So in garbage collection, your goal is to preserve the live objects and recycle the space for everything that's not live. A live object is an object that's referred to from the roots, or any object which is referred to from any other live object. It's a circular definition, right? And this set expands as you trace the graph of objects. So what are the roots? We have global variables, okay? And we also have any local that's on an active stack frame. So you have 10 stack frames deep. If you did a backtrace, you'd see 10 frames. In those frames, they're probably holding on to garbage collected values. Those are the roots, right? You start with these values, and you see what values they reference. We have no way to visit the stack in WebAssembly, unlike in a native compiler. And this leads to a lot of problems. This is good in a way, because it's an abstraction over the platform, and you don't have like stack smashing attacks. But it's bad for shipping a linear memory GC. It makes it more difficult. There are two workarounds here. One is manually keep track of all the roots. Some language runtimes can do this, right? Unfortunately, this is going to be overhead, because every time you add another local variable, you have to also perform some bookkeeping that makes it visible to the garbage collector. So you're now building a system that's slower than it could be. Or you could simply tell your compiler to put everything in memory, and you're not going to do any bookkeeping, But on the other hand, you're not going to be able to precisely know what the roots are. This is called conservative garbage collection. This can work. It's not a bad solution. It's what most garbage collectors in WebAssembly do, actually. The state-of-the-art solution is neither of these, right? You have the compiler emit a side table for the garbage collector's use, telling the garbage collector where to find the local variables. But you can't do that, right? Because we have no way to communicate with any garbage collector. We have no way to know where we are in the stack in WebAssembly. It's a drag. It's annoying. It gets worse. Like you start to look at building this system with linear memory and GC. First of all, if you're building a web application, you're aiming to deploy your WebAssembly on the web, then you're going to probably have callbacks from JavaScript, and JavaScript is going to reference WebAssembly objects. This is a very common pattern. It's almost impossible to avoid it. So you're going to have cycles between the JavaScript heap with its garbage collector and our linear memory heap, and these things don't know anything about each other. These cycles, in practice, are going to be uncollectible. You're going to lead to memory leaks. It's pretty annoying in that sense. Maybe your application doesn't live so long, so it's okay, but okay, it's another annoyance. And then finally, when you give an object to JavaScript, you give it as an integer, specifically an index into that linear memory. And so if JavaScript wants to read or write to that object, it has to have a capability over all linear memory. You have no abstraction at that point. To an extent, if you ship the JavaScript that talks to your WebAssembly, you can maybe try to preserve some of these abstractions, but it's not a good system. And then if you manage to compact memory, only if you have precise roots, you can't give the memory back to the operating system. There are some pending proposals to do this, but it's not the case yet. So, I mean, in the eternal dialectic between worse is better and worse is worse, or are we going to build a thing that just sort of works, or are we going to build the right thing? I think most people in this room are more on the right thing side of things, right? Okay, you know, nobody's completely in one camp or the other, but if you're one of these persons and you check your gut, you're like, no, I'm going to wait, right? Because this is not good enough. The thing that's just so galling about this is that there's a garbage collector right there, right? You're shipping your code into a browser that has an excellent garbage collector. Why can't I just use this? Please. And so in the grand sports ball of C++ versus Haskell, C++ is just, you know, scoring goals, right? Like they are winning on WebAssembly and we are not. But it's halftime and some things are changing, right? And the good news, I'm here to bring you the good news, right? The good news is that we are going to have support for garbage collection in WebAssembly. And I believe, I mean, it's hard to predict, especially about the future, but I believe this is going to ship this year, right? End of this year. And so what does that mean? We're back in the game, right? We can play, but we have to be ready for it. So we have to build the compilers that compile our languages to WebAssembly now. We can do this already because there's some sort of preview version shipping. In this talk, I want to go over a strategy that I'm using to compile Scheme to WebAssembly. In a collaboration between the company I work with, Igalia and Sprightly Institute, we're building a compiler for all of Guile, eventually, but starting with a subset of Scheme. And the approach that we're taking here is that we're going to try to avoid cutting corners. When you target JavaScript, for example, you have a very strong incentive to make your numbers the same as JavaScript's numbers. You have a strong incentive to, like, for example, omit multiple value returns or your different aspects of your language that don't quite fit with your target platform. In this case, we're going to try to just bring the whole language, like see where do we get and what are the difficulties we find. And I think I've found mostly solutions for all of these. So let's start with values and specifically how do we work with the garbage collector. The WebAssembly garbage collection proposal, the GC proposal, has three top types. It's very funny. You have the anyref type tree, which is the ones that you defined in WebAssembly. You have extern, which are maybe values from JavaScript, if we talk about a web embedding. And then functions are represented differently for reasons. You can't compare anyrefs by identity, but there's a subtype called ek that you can compare by identity. You can say, is this value the same as that one? And then of X, there are three subtypes, one of them concrete, being I31s, 31-bit integers. These are fixed nums, which is great, right? We need fixed nums, right, in our languages. And then we have structs, records, and arrays. And structs and arrays are abstract types. They have concrete types for their fields. So in Scheme, we're going to use ref ek, a reference to the ek type, as our common value representation. We'll represent immediate values using I31s. And some of that space will be for fixed nums, and some will be for like the true value, the false value, characters, Scheme differentiates between characters and strings, and so on. Additionally, in WebAssembly, value types are not nullable by default. You have to explicitly mark types as being nullable. In the case of Scheme, we don't need null, so we're going to do without it. This is going to make our compilation a little bit more efficient. For heap objects, which is everything that's not a fixed num, small integer, or like false or something like that, then we're going to have a subtype of struct. And concretely, we're going to have a common supertype for all of these. I didn't think this was going to be necessary before. But the GC proposal has what's called structural type equivalence. The types that you define in your module are compared by shape and not by name. And so you can have a number of different types that actually declare the same shapes of fields, and they would be seen as equivalent to WebAssembly. And so you wouldn't be able to use the WebAssembly's type test primitives to differentiate between them. We need to be able to do dynamic type checking in Scheme. So we need a field with a type tag value. That's going to be how we do dynamic type checks. We also need to be able to hash values on their identity. And so we need a space for a hash value, just as in Java. So we're going to use that one I32 field that every object on the heap is going to have, and that's going to have the hash code and the type tag. So for example, a pair will be a subtype of heap object with the first I32 field, which is that tag and hash field. You have to mention all the supertype fields when you make the subtype. And then it's going to have two other fields, which are our car and our coder of our pair. Okay, great. It shows defining specific struct types and subtyping. You can also subtype functions and arrays. And if we look at our const function, then it's a function that takes two arguments. Both of them are references to ek, and it creates a new struct. And then the system manages it. It's wonderful. And if we want to access the first field, we use struct get. And when this code is compiled on V8, for example, which is my usual testing platform for this, it's quite efficient, actually. It's even more efficient than if you compile the JavaScript, because there are fewer extraneous cases that you might have to handle. I put in bold here that this car function, which I put with a percent before the name, indicating it's kind of like internal or a system function. It's because the parameter is the concrete type of the pair. You don't get any sort of magic to cast an instance of the unitype, ref ek, to this concrete type. You need to do dynamic type checking, which is the horror that is in the next slide, right? I have two bits that are in bold. It's kind of hard to see on the slides here, but on the top we have a test to see if the object has the right shape. We use ref test against the shape pair. And if that doesn't work, then we branch out and call type error. And then we actually have to get the type field and mask off the low byte and check that against the expected type tag, in our case one. If that doesn't equal, we branch off and call type error. Otherwise, we can actually call the internal function, or inline that internal function if you like. That's value representation, right? This is how we use the WebAssembly proposal to define types and represent the source language's types using GC types. Scheme is funny. It's got a number of interesting challenges, and one of them for WebAssembly also is varArgs, a variable number of arguments. So let's look into this. The issue is that functions are strongly typed in WebAssembly. If a function says it takes two arguments and they have the type I32 and F64, it can only be called with those types of arguments. Whereas in Scheme, not only do we call functions with values of any type, we can call them with any number of values. And that might raise a runtime error if you're calling a function with the wrong number of values. But some functions can accept multiple number of values. And in Guile, for example, we use this facility for parsing out keyword arguments or optional arguments or things like this. So how are we going to use what WebAssembly gives us, which is strongly typed functions, to represent functions that can take a variable number of arguments? And the solution is a little bit gnarly, but it's a local transform. It's not really a whole program transform. We effectively do what for example, the x86-64 calling convention is, in which you allocate some number of registers to the first n parameters, and then otherwise you require your parameters to be passed in memory. When you call a function, you pass the number of parameters that you're giving it. And given that number of parameters, that function will know, A, is it the right number of parameters? And B, where do I find my values? Like, I will find them in, if I'm passed with five parameters, I will find them in arg0, arg1, arg2, arg3, and then one of them will be in memory. Right? And the callee would then be responsible for loading these values into its locals, which will get properly register allocated, and then and continuing like that. So our uniform function type is going to take one parameter, which is going to be the number of arguments that we get. You can imagine a form of global register allocation in which these global variables are actually allocated to RDI and RSI and the actual registers that the machine uses for register allocation. And I don't think this is going to happen in practice, but it's a thought. Okay, but anyway, we have varargs in there. Great. It's not too bad. We're moving on. What about tail calls? This is always the story with Scheme. Like we're always like, tail calls, I can't compile to this platform. Frank, I almost cried when I made this slide. It's just going to be there. It's just there. You know? Well, the instructions return call instead of call, and return call ref if you're calling a function by value. They do tail calls. It's great. It's really great. These aren't quite in the spec yet, but I think they'll land at the same time as GC. So I'm just delighted. This is the part that I like best about this presentation. Later, when I'm done, y'all will tell me what you think. Because maybe you won't. So if we take the problem statement of like, I want lightweight multi-threading, right? Many languages have this. It's kind of table stakes, fibers, virtual threads, whatever you want to call them. What am I going to do to implement lightweight multi-threading? Well, eventually WebAssembly might have support for this, right? Coroutines. This is a bit far off. So I wouldn't bet on it right now. There's also a strategy which can be to compile everything as if there's no coroutines, and then run a post-pass on the whole WebAssembly module using this toolkit called Binarian, which is part of the compilation toolchain to WebAssembly for many projects, to make some functions resumable. It's a little gnarly. I don't think it's ready for GC yet, but Julia uses this in its compilation to linear memory GC. The other option is to implement limit continuations somehow, and then build your fibers on that. This is a relatively straightforward process, but not the subject of this talk. Since the limit continuations are part of Guile anyway, I wanted to have them in there for sure. And so, that's my strategy for lightweight concurrency. I don't know how many people have actually worked with the Scheme for delimited continuations. I would expect like two in this room. So a little bit of an overview for it. Delimited continuations are called delimited because there's a prompt. In the same way that in an operating system, like say you're at the shell, the prompt delimits the operating system, the thing that's running the processes, from the process that you run. right? When the process that you run dies, it doesn't kill your whole machine, it just brings you back to the prompt, right? This is a pretty rough analogy, but it's one of the original ones when the facility was created in the 80s. So call it prompt effectively establishes a prompt in your program. So you get a division between its continuation and the continuation that's being called. It has a name. This prompt has a tag called foo. That's just the name we'll give to the prompt. And then it has the body of the prompt, which in this case is a function that's going to run. It's going to add 34 to... there we have abort to prompt. This is the part where I suspend this continuation, return to the handler with a reified copy of that continuation, and in this case I just returned as a value. And so if I run k, which is this captured continuation, and I pass it an argument, it's going to be as if that abort to prompt returned with that argument. That if you consider the function of no arguments, lambda plus 34 whole, right? The k is that whole, effectively. Right. It's a function which, when run, will reinstate that continuation and put the value in the whole and then return. There's a lot more to say about this stuff, but I'm going to just go on to discuss how this works. So in practice, there are a few ways to embed delimited continuations, but the way I like to do it is as a stack slice. Logically speaking, you have your stack. Let's say it's going down, right? You're calling, your function goes down, oh, prompt. Okay, now you're inside your prompt, oh, abort. What is the continuation? It's this stack slice between the prompt and the abort, reified as an object. And to reinstate it, you compose it with the current continuation wherever you are. If you call one of these reified continuations, it splats back on that stack, composing it with the current continuation, and restarts it with whatever value you pass into it. This is my intuition for what a delimited continuation actually is. And so to implement this on WebAssembly, what I'm doing in Scheme is that I'm running a transformation that turns... This is a little weird. It's called a continuation passing transformation, a particular variant of one, that turns all non-tail calls, all calls that you would need to return to, into tail calls. And it does so by, when you get to one of these calls, the compiler knows what variables are going to be needed when it returns, and so the compiler will push those values on an explicit stack. And then it will tail call, and it will also push where to return onto another stack. And then it tail calls the function you're calling. So when that function returns, I think I have this in the next slide, actually. So before a call, I push the live out variables onto a stack, I push the return continuation on a stack, and I tail call the callee. When that callee returns, it pops the continuation from the stack, and then tail calls it. And that return point is then responsible for taking those values that I pushed onto the stack and pulling them back into local variables. What does this give you? It gives you a reified stack that you can slice, which is exactly what you need to implement delimited continuations. Calling a prompt just captures the current level of the stacks, and aborting to a prompt slurps out those values into some heap object, and then tail calls whatever the prompt's continuation was. And you never have this problem of like needing to jump up and down of the control stack because all your calls are tail calls. It's a little deep. My favorite part, but it's a little detailed. Right. The cool thing is that with this arrangement of delimited continuations, we don't need to wait on anything else. We can ship delimited continuations now, and we don't need to wait on like the effect handler's proposal. We can have effect handlers now, and we don't need to wait on anything else. And incidentally, this also gives you a good error handling story, because whenever there's an error, you just tail call the error handler, and it has all the state reified that it needs to inspect, for example, to give you a backtrace in terms of your own language, or to be able to let you debug and inspect local variables in terms of your own language, or even to modify local variables and resume the continuation. Right. So We've done the first four. We've done values, we've done verargs, tail calls, limit configurations. Also, Scheme has this, although all values are the same type in the sense of Bob Harper's unit type, we do have different kinds of values, right? We have exact integers, we have inexact reals, we have complex numbers and fractions and all kinds of crazy things. When you run the web, the nice thing is that in the same way that you have a garbage collector that's just right there at your reach, right there at your disposal, you also have a good implementation of arbitrary precision integers, which is bigint. So when we need to reach for the general case of where, how do we represent like a big integer, we don't need to just rely on it fitting into a floating point number. We can use a proper bigint value, and then we can use the built-in operations on these bigints, which are also going to be efficient. The result is that you can ship a system with support for all kinds of different numbers, and you don't have to have it. You don't have to have such a big binary size for your module that you're shipping. Of course, for small numbers, we're going to take advantage of the I31 fixed nums, or I31 immediates, a subspace of which we're going to reserve for fixed nums. And for floating point numbers, we also have to, unfortunately, make them, in the general case, to be heap objects, unless the compiler can unbox them for whatever reason. If you are compiling to a non-web target, though, you obviously can't rely on bigint. But since the way that WebAssembly modules compose with each other and with host facilities is actually the same, you can implement that bigint functionality via another WebAssembly module. So if you're running your code on like Fastly's Edge Compute platform, then you compose your Scheme module with the module providing effectively bigint services, which might be compiled from like GMP or mini GMP or something like this. Right. And that pretty much covers it. You know, like when I got to this point that I realized that we could do everything, I was like, oh, it's go time. We are going to get Scheme on the web platform, and I'm happy to be able to work on this right now. These aren't the only considerations if you're targeting WebAssembly, of course. It's a weird machine, and the solutions are weird. For my case, for debugging, I'm going to rely mostly on since schemes tend to be self-hosted in important ways, I'm going to continue to rely on the self-hosted debugging facilities to inspect these limit continuations. But the hosts also have support for Dwarf, which you embed in a separate section of your binary, or perhaps fetch it asynchronously to complement your binary with external debugging symbols. If you need to identify like where you are in a bit of code, it's limited. Dwarf wasn't made for WebAssembly. Dwarf was made for machines with fixed numbers of registers, for example, not an infinite number of locals, but there it is. For strings, I'm partial to using the strings from JavaScript as well. JavaScript strings are a little weird also, but you can represent all values there. They're a particularly good match if you're compiling JVM languages or CLR languages, languages that were defined in the age of UTF-16. This proposal is a little, there is a proposal which is in Chrome now, which I've worked on. It's a little bit less sure. So I'm not going to say, like, definitely use string ref, even though I got it. When it comes to interoperation with JavaScript, the weird thing about this is that when you pass a value to JavaScript, it's not an index into linear memory. It is an opaque capability, if you will. You can do nothing with it. This is the state of the compromise between JavaScript and WebAssembly. To be able to access anything on this object, you have to call in to the WebAssembly module itself, which would then be able to destructure it or assign values to it or what have you. So your module actually needs to export a few accessors, and then in JavaScript, if you were going to have a nice interface, then you would need to wrap this object with some JavaScript wrapper. And just a final couple nerdy points. For some languages, it's important to be able to generate code at runtime. And in WebAssembly, there will probably be a proposal to be able to do this at some point. It's not there yet. What you can do now is you can actually generate bytes for a new WebAssembly module if you need to generate JIT code, and then instantiate that module in such a way that it shares state with your host. There are a lot of details here, and I have a blog post on this if y'all are interested. Finally, there is a WebAssembly to C translator, WASM to C. It doesn't work with GC yet, but it could. And what this would give you for a language that compiles to WebAssembly is ahead of time compilation to any CPU. So you don't need to build your RISC-V backend in a way. You can compile your code to WebAssembly and then use one of these ahead of time WASM to C or WASM to native compilers to produce a native standalone binary for any platform, which is pretty tempting. And so, with the GC proposal, I think that, like I say, we're in halftime, right? C++ has scored a bunch of goals, but I think we're in a good position to equalize in the second half. It's simply a small matter of programming to build these compilers and runtimes and such, but I think the time is now. If you'd like to follow along with the scheme work, it's still pretty early days, but there's a GitHub repository with where I've been experimenting. And otherwise, it's been a delight, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Yeah, I especially like WebAssembly S expression syntax. That's quite familiar. So, questions?
Last time I checked the garbage collection MVP in WebAssembly, it doesn't support weak pointers and finalizers. I'm not sure if Scheme supports these type of language features, so how are you going to be implementing those?
Very good question. I think the consensus right now is that this is a host concern. And so to implement weak pointers, you would call out to JavaScript and use weak maps, right, which is ephemerons, and actually ephemeron tables. It's a pretty good facility. And on an edge platform, they would need to implement it in some other way. Similarly, for finalizers, there's a JavaScript finalization that's out there in all the browsers, and so you would call out and use JavaScript. It's not the kind of finalizer that can resuscitate objects, for better or for worse. So it's really post-mortem finalization. That is the sense in which you do have to truncate language to platform if that's an important thing for your language. Yeah.
Follow up? Another question is that you mentioned that if you ship your own garbage collector via linear memory, then you have the problem of cycles between the two heaps. But if you are shipping your own garbage collector, then your own garbage collector can know when the object is going to be collected on the linear memory. And on the other side, on the JavaScript heap, you have things like finalizer registry. So you can also have some hooks to fire when JavaScript object is garbage collected. So I'm sure these two facilities will allow some kind of circle breaking between the two.
That's a good point. Actually, there's one way that you can break cycles, which is for any link in the cycle to be weak. In that case, it works. It's tough to ensure this by construction, but finalizers alone won't do this because the WebAssembly to JavaScript link is strong generally. Well, no, that one can be seen by the GIS in linear memory. Okay. The WebAssembly to JavaScript link is usually strong, and similarly, the JavaScript to WebAssembly link is often strong as well. This is like a combination of ref counting and tracing. They really can't do the cycle. To my understanding, I've looked into this a bit, but that's my understanding that it's not something that's amenable to like building robust, reliable systems in which you know that it has a property that cycles will be collected. But there are workarounds, you're right.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi, thanks for the talk. I was wondering about your slide on type checking, or runtime type checking, and you said WASM has a sort of structural type equality. And I'm wondering, is that linear in the size of the object, or?
No. One way to implement this is, so, all right, backing up a little bit. What you want here, right? It, on the web, all objects on the heap have a hidden class or a map word or a structure in the first word. And this points off to something that describes what the object looks like. It's in all the engines. And each object of a different shape has a different map word. And so if you're going to compare objects that they are the same, exactly the same shape, for example, for final types and subtypes, then you should be able to just compare those map words. This is what you want. WebAssembly doesn't have this right now. That is nominal typing or runtime typing. And so what instead has is structural typing. Okay. There is an O1 way to implement this in which you still have the map word internally. As part of that structure, you have a list of all the supertypes of the value. And if they share a common prefix, and if the value at a certain, if they share, let's say you're asking if X is a subtype of Y, right, structurally. First of all, what that means structurally is, in the terms of WebAssembly, is do they have the same fields? The first number of fields, and is one marked as a subtype of the other, right? So you're really checking like a linear subtyping hierarchy, and that's something you can do with an O1 operation. But I'm not explaining myself very well, but it's not a linear check to do that.
That's perfect. That's all I want. Thank you.
Yeah. I thought that JHC has a WebAssembly backend these days.
Are they winning? Huh? Are they winning though?
I don't know. Does it have all the disadvantages they talked about, or?
Well, I mean, so I don't know if they're winning, right? So I don't profess the knowledge in that regard.
I'm working on it.
Are you working on winning? I hope so, yeah. Now is the time. But I would suspect that it is slower than it could be, because you can't implement GC over linear memory as fast as a system with the host garbage collector. Rough approximation. And I would suspect also that the binary size of these compiled artifacts is larger than you would want. And I would also suspect that interoperability with the host, in particular JavaScript, is suboptimal. But you're absolutely right that you can get it to work right now. And I think Haskell is probably, you know, well positioned, already having this, to take advantage of the built-in garbage collector.
We have time for one last question.
Okay, so I have a question about controlled flow. So when you translate your program, well, into protocol calls, you're stop using the hardware stack.
Yes.
And yeah. So you will lose some efficiency.
Yeah.
And every program, even programs that do not use delimited continuations, have to pay for cost.
Yeah.
Have you measured this?
No, I haven't done it.
Okay, and with Western to see how does it deal with tail calls? Because, I mean, the C platform does not have tail calls.
I think it probably doesn't. I haven't checked, actually. But since tail calls aren't part of the official standard right now, I don't think that Western C would support them right now. That's a good question. With regards to the CPS conversion, I completely agree there's going to be a performance hit. Hopefully not too bad, because hopefully your program is spending time in inner loops, and inner loops without a call inside them don't need to undergo this separation into multiple functions and weird call convention.
Great talk. Thank you very much.